the second episode of the Break It Till You Make It podcast. In this episode, we'll be talking to Barbara Rauch and Jay Irizawa, who were the professors in my summer class, Thinking Through Making. They were highly influential in my final work and also the methodologies of combining studio with practice was highly influential in my final project. We'll be reflecting upon some of the successes and also some of the teaching philosophies that they share.
Oh. Don't worry about that. It just tells you that it's being recorded now.
Yeah, that changes everything what we say, isn't it? No, you know what I was thinking when I heard you talk about the Thinking Through Making?
Yeah.
Actually, you know, this program was really, the course was on our radar for a long time. It didn't just come, Jay, actually, when you were teaching it 2 years ago for the first time, it was in planning much longer. It was actually when I was still IMD program director, we were already thinking of that gap in our, how can we deliver a studio program, you know, such as the IMD or the DF or any interdisciplinary practice-based program to our students when we have so little access to shops and maker labs and technicians, etc. So in the end, you know, we were really fighting for that space to engage with our students in the making more thoroughly. And it was actually Judith Doyle and Philippe Blanchard who came up with the idea of putting this into the summer term, because that would free all the space constraints that we have in the shops at Town of McCall during the year. There is so much more space in the summer. And that got us talking with the right people over there, McCall, with Nick Cooper, the manager of the labs, of the studio shops there. And from there, we built this course. We got it approved. And then I think Martha probably approached Jay. And Jay, did you teach it on your own for the first year, or was that with Imani? I can't remember.
That was with Imani. So Imani and myself.
Yeah, and you just kicked that off then so beautifully in a couple of years ago. You wrote right. The course, you know, you made it so hands-on, you tied it in with the studios, and I'll let you take over now. I just want to give a little bit of the history of this. Didn't just come up quickly, you know, it was really for a long time a desire that DF and IMD wanted to bring the practice to students more full-fledged.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think it's important. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Frank.
No, I just also wanted to talk about, like, was it conscious to actually have students train in safety before you actually engaged with the studio equipment? Because that was really something that really helped me also.
Absolutely. Nick Cooper insisted, and we all insisted on that, to really be a part of the deliverable, you know?
Yeah.
And I think, Jay, you made it an assignment. You made it a graded assignment almost.
Actually, Nick had created that part of the program to be able to just have everything available online. So I think the materials were already developed and it was just a matter of plugging it in. And this brings to mind something, Frank, something that you had maybe started a conversation about just shortly after the course, after you completed the course, which was about how we can integrate safety planning in a more direct way, and potentially, as your suggestion was, to have QR codes next to the equipment so that we can have real-time learning, I suppose, you know, to access guides and things. And I think that is something that is really simple and potentially, you know, viable to do, whether it's in this institution or other institutions as well, and easily updatable too. So I think, Frank, that might be something to pursue for you to pursue, and maybe for us to start to think about too.
I can't emphasize that enough, because that saved my fingers, literally saved me having five digits on my hands. This winter, my drainage got backed up and I had a sewage problem, right? And I watched a few videos. I had to get these drain guys, but they were like $500 or whatever. So I went to Home Depot and I watched some videos on YouTube, and I said, like, you know, I'm a maker now, so I should be able to do this. So I bought this equipment, and it was this huge thing, and it was looked nothing like the guy on YouTube, but I said, you know what, I'm going to do it anyway. And at the side of all of this stuff, there was no manual, and it's this snake thing which goes at a very high torque. And at the side of it was this little small QR code. And I was like, how do I use this? And I looked at the QR code and it said instructions. And I scanned it with my phone, and it had instructions from maybe, I think, 10 years ago. It was really bad video, but it actually told me, when you're using it, use leather gloves instead of using normal gloves, because for whatever reason, they said, use, that is what is safe to do with this thing. And I just took that one piece of advice and I did it, because when it actually got stuck and started moving around like crazy, it actually squeezed my fingers. I thought my eyeballs were going to come out of my eyes. And I stopped it. I got off that thing. But, you know, that one safety thing really saved my skin. And the same thing with thinking through making. You guys said, you guys have to do this. Like, this is not optional. You don't go on the bandsaw if you don't know how, you haven't got the training yet, right? And that was like, yes, that is right. That is what it is all about, because those things, one slip and you can lose a finger, you can lose a digit, right? Like, you know, and it seems pretty simple, but there's technique involved. There's certain things that you have to do in certain sequence involved. And I really appreciated you putting those barriers to entry. Getting us to think about that before we engage in a studio-based class, basically.
I think that's interesting, you know, to maybe also move from that not only safety but also fear. So, you know, a lot of people have fear, you know, to even go near a bandsaw or any tool. We have been so much with our electronic technologies, digital, you know, we are now so versed in computing that we have a little bit more fear with really handling materials and tools. I think having a safety training might be an entry to working with wood or metal or doing a cast, you know, that finding access to a technician is the other thing. So we had also technicians in the room who were constantly around, you know, if you got stuck, they let you in peace experimenting, but they were also there if you needed them. So I wonder if you had any insights on, you know, how important is it to have the technicians in the classroom? Because for me, this was unique. I don't know if Jay, in design, you have a bit more of that, but you know, there is unfortunately such a bad separation in the classroom. We are usually without the technicians. In the shops, we have the technicians, but not the teachers. So I consider the technician as much a teacher as I do the academic instructor, you know. So I wish, you know, our classrooms were always equipped with technicians. I would love to call them teachers, because they're teaching us how to use the materials and the tools. They help us with finding the right solutions for how the material works. They help us with the concepts. So, you know, how can we be so foolish to think that one is separated from the other?
Yes. I think what was unique, Jay, that you did was we actually had the whole class in the studio itself. You like took the laptop and like we were in the studio space, and then it also became the classroom, right? And if you could just speak to that.
Well, that was actually partly out of necessity during that particular time, since they were doing renovations. The year prior to that, we did have a separate breakout room where we would start and have more of a formalized introduction, and even when we were starting to do critiques and progress, in progress demonstrations or showing, you know, the works that were being in development, it changed the environment, changed the atmosphere, and the the nature of the dialogue, I think, where it became much more, much more theorized or theoretical. And I think in some ways it removed us from getting right into the material itself, the object. So I think, you know, whether it was happenstance or something that was intuitively planned, it really works well when, and I think Barbara, you probably were the one to say, why don't we just do it here, right? Where we were doing presentations and it kept the energy within the space itself. So the environments, you know, to have a studio of one's own, shall we say, I think it's really important to maintain that energy and it sets the tone for what is being produced, I think, and how the process itself becomes part of that product. And maybe that leads to back to your first question about how the course had been developed. And full transparency here, I mean, I was formerly a student of Barbara's. So I think due in part to some of my own learning and training as a designer and teaching at another institution, paired with some of the philosophical aspects of approaching materials from an artistic practice, I think has certainly been due in part to some of Barbara's my dialogue with Barbara years ago, where we were constantly thinking about the process itself as being the product, as being the thing that we are constantly in dialogue with, and it doesn't finish just when the process itself finishes, but it continues as a dialogue.
Yeah, Barbara, you can I've had like two classes with you in my time at OCAD, and you have this very process oriented way of like an experiential way of actually conducting the class, where you not only want to engage people in the theory of things, but you want to take people through the experience of something. Like you would take us out into looking at exhibitions, and then you know give us this context about a safe space. I mean, that was really important when we were talking about like, you know, being in a classroom setting and like being in this vulnerable state where we don't know all the answers. And like, just like, if you could just elaborate a little bit on your philosophy of how you approach this, like your teaching style for designing a course.
I mean, broadly speaking, I think you're putting your finger onto, you know, the bringing you out into different scenarios, you know, where we are in a way differently vulnerable, you know, in academic surrounding, you know, we would maybe be emphasizing on assignment and reading and theory, but out there in the world, we face different problems, you know. So when I take a class, and not necessarily only graduate students, but I also take my, and Jay, you will do maybe speak to your processes as well. I take my students to the AGO and I figure out that, you know, exposing them to contemporary artists and designers and their thinking and their big themes that they are taking on, that everything in a way is possible, you know, as long as you're pursuing it with a rigor. Yeah. So I want to give them this potentially world-embracing experience, you know, that I think maybe some students fear me for that because I'm appearing so serious about that, you know, world outside is important for us to reflect about. It's quite safe to be a good student, but how does it feel when we are taking this outside of the classroom?
Yeah.
I think it has to do with that, but also I'm, you know, although I have a PhD, although I am a scholar, but I'm actually at the first point of discussion would be that I'm pursuing this whole scholarship as an artist, as a maker, as a practitioner, a hands-on person that I'm fighting for not to lose my practice. practice, you know, over this whole theoretical conceptual framework. And I think for our students in IMD, NDF, and other programs, more and more, I think we need to fight for that space that the practice has a place for knowledge holding. So, you know, we are not turning you into theorists. We are actually pursuing our scholarship through practice. So if it's not a material practice, it might be a digital practice, but it's the studio work that I think we need to look a little more closely to finding how does this speculation with material hold knowledge? And that's not necessarily the theory or the concept out there. You know, that's the dialogue for you in your process thinking. And that's maybe why I have so much emphasis on, actually, you know, I'm not so much interested in the end product, but in your negotiation with the process, the material process. Yeah. And you could maybe almost label this old-fashioned, because then you could say, oh, you're really a studio, a maker, person, you know, have you not understood that translation into where we are today, you know? So there's this kind of maybe a little bit of hanging on to the studio as a place where I can experiment, I can tease my material, I can tease my own skills, I can find out where the gaps are. And it equips me with a language that I need to build to be able to communicate to, let's say, technicians or people outside in the world who could help me to produce what I want to do. But sometimes I find my own way of making something. And I think you as graduate students, you're the next educators, you know. So I also see my role in teaching and working with you and thinking with you. I learn a lot from you, but you also can start thinking about yourself as educators. It's not so much about the product you're doing, but about the skill that you're building with the making of that thing.
I think that is absolutely something I took away from that. And I think Jay said it in class once. It's he actually emphasized, I think one of the lectures that you were giving, Jay, you actually emphasized understanding the language of design, like, you know, and you actually were saying it's really important to actually be able to articulate what you are making in terms of design. And that really stuck to me like glue, like, you know, like, am I able to articulate? Am I able to actually, like, the word, like words like affordances were like, so, I mean, I've heard the word before, but I didn't have an understanding of it. I didn't have an embodiment of what it meant, right? When it came to material. And you, I think, come from an architectural background, is that right, in some ways? And, you know?
Yes, environmental design, interior design.
And you were really bringing in all those terms and those ways of looking at materials and things like that. And you were sharing your processes. I think that really, you know, I really took that on because, like, all of my explorations after that was all about materials and like the final end product that I actually showed you guys was basically a curation process of basically a whole bunch of materials I was going to use from my classrooms, right? It wasn't even a finished product. I mean, I had prototypes which I did with it, but like, I mean, if you could just talk a little bit about, like, you know, that mindset of thinking about design through words, like, would be really nice.
Language, that's, for me, language is much more than words. It's about the communication of space and how that becomes sometimes an overriding influence in how we communicate. Just as we were talking about the environment of the studio itself, that sets the tone for the types of dialogue we will have. But getting to your specific point about the language of design, how we need to articulate the objectives or the affects and the effects as well. How do I start? I think that the way that we speak about design is an agential practice. It is a material discursive practice that changes the ways in which we are engaging with the material itself as we talk through it, as we handle it, as we discuss about its nuances of smell and even sound. All of these things start to shape our ideals and ideas of cultural associations, all the things that are informed from our childhood. These are the worlds that we embody and that we then articulate in order to bring new worlds through the creations that we make for others to see and hear and feel and be affected by. So I think, as many people have been, and I'm not saying that this is a bad thing, but I've been classically trained, shall we say, in the modernist and contemporary aspect of what design is and what it can be and what it does, as in we identify a challenge in order to find an opportunity to solve. And I'm less so, I don't know if you remember, but I had a particular chart about the design trajectory that much more into a final point or of resolution. And I don't adhere to that as much anymore. In fact, I'd rather invert that process by seeing how design and art, so design being influenced through art, artistic practices and methods of discovery, how that can invert our thinking so that we're not looking for a quantifiable endpoint, but rather can we maybe subvert the question itself of what makes good design, but what good can we make out of questions, and how can we challenge hierarchies of design, of history, and what we've inherited as having value. And because design is so quantified, how can we look at those qualitative aspects, some of which Barbara was also talking about? And can we value, can we look at a return on investment in a different way outside of the a capitalist model of what design will finally produce and entail. And one last thing, I guess, coming from a advertising background too, working in agencies, a lot of the language itself, and this isn't from my own theory, this is from a couple theorists, Kim and Mauborn, who in 2006 came out with a book called The Blue Ocean Strategy. And in their very first opening chapter, they talked about the language of advertising as having militaristic derivatives of execution and, you know, targets, demographic. And so even during those times, I was wondering, how can we invert the language of how we talk about design in advertising, design in industrial design, whatever it might be, so that it's not concretizing the these notions. And perhaps we can look at it in new ways and in some ways also very old ways, as in a maybe in a cultural sense of reciprocity and relationship. How do we open up the language so that it also is inclusive and accessible? And of course, these are also big buzzwords in design too, because it's very marketable. But what does it take for it to truly be a design for people? I guess I'll just end off there.
Yeah, and I think that, like, this whole differentiation that you bring about commercial design and like design away from capitalism, I think that is like at the core of what thinking through making was for me, because I think I wasn't thinking so much that this has to be an end product which is going to be beneficial in a concrete way, but like it is like, what is my process and what is my thinking, and it I don't know whether that can be done in the commercial world, because we always have to come up with an end product, which is, you know, but I hope there is some way that we can bring this kind of practice. I mean, I know I use it now regularly in my own design practice when I'm thinking about things, but, you know, in a commercial sense, whether companies can adopt something like that. And I don't even know if there is an answer, but maybe there is. I just hope that the Thinking Through Making class continues, and you know, it continues to evolve like the way it has. And I think if it was, this is just my bias, but if it could be bought and made a compulsory thing, like for safety to be really at the forefront of when you're starting your journey in the graduate program, right? And like, you know, getting all those hands-on tools, because your making is so much more informed in some ways. Like once you have that confidence, like Barbara was talking about, like, I can do this, I actually know how to use, power tool with some confidence, and I can actually
go driver.
Right? And it seems like a small thing, Barbara, but like even using a power screwdriver, like I would hang every frame crooked, and my wife would like.
But you know, it's interesting. We have had this discussion where would a safety training for a graduate student fit in? And we have seriously considered to, even before you would enter the university, you would have the safety training. So you're ready to go when fall comes. Not this year, obviously, but in the years before, we were really thinking, where would we fit this in? And when is the right time for a graduate student to know about all the possibilities that there are? But we have really... constraints with our small workshops at Hunter McCall, with so many students on the undergraduate level, to really fit you in as well. That's why the Maker Lab at 205 Richmond, you know, was a good solution, but it's also interim. It's an interim solution. It's not big enough. It's not equipped enough. It's not manned enough, to really have you embrace practice on the level that I see you graduate students working. Let's go back to one issue that we didn't really talk about, and I took little notes here. And, you know, it's such a pleasure, Jay, working with you, you know, because you bring a different language into the classroom that I cannot bring. Some design thinking, but also, your new direction with your cultural environmental scan and the histories that you want to bring to your practice now. It's so encouraging to see how, you know, different disciplinary thinkings can come together in the classroom. Mm. And particularly at a moment of time when we see the discipline almost being dismantled. You know, the narrowness of expertise within a discipline is questioned. So what is the new knowledge that we are pursuing from now on, if we say there is no such thing as a disciplinary expertise? So if I speak to a graduate student who is obviously doing research in a field, what field is that? How can we frame the poroseness of the boundaries that we're pursuing with this kind of interdisciplinary, cross or transdisciplinary or post-disciplinary or non-disciplinary? You know, every year we add a level of where are we with the disciplinary thinking. So I find this interesting, challenging, confusing, and speculative. How are we pursuing the field that we can no longer hold? And it's an open question, you know, that I can just leave open in a room, maybe for Frank or you, Jay, to also comment on. But there is a moment in time, I think, that we're experiencing, maybe also with the pandemic, that, you know, disciplines have to work together to overcome the largeness of the problems we are facing, you know, the globalness of our thinking and being and acting. And it's not only environmental now, it's our health. It's you know, come much closer now. It's not only out there, earth and environment, it's actually ourselves, our safety is questioned. So there's something very urgent for us as researchers and makers and thinkers and human beings to think about.
Yeah, it's funny. I was just having a conversation with a class the other day about how throughout the whole semester we were talking about the concept of paradigms and paradigm shifts. And then I said, well, here we are. I mean, this is the paradigm shift that will change the way that we engage and interact socially, you know, behaviorally, attitudinally. And we started to just started to scratch the surface in terms of what this means. What it does is it opens up the possibilities for a large shift in the intent of things, and maybe we can start to think about longer term solutions rather than just an immediate game where it's not a zero sum game anymore, where the only way that we can win is if, or gain something is if someone else loses something. But this brings us to a point where we have very little resources left now to continue in the way that we have been. So, and I said somewhere along the line, is somewhere in the next few months, someone's going to coin a lot of terminology about this new consciousness or new zeitgeist movement, and maybe it will gain traction. I don't know, but it does make us think about interdisciplinarity in a new way, and in our microcosm of thinking through making, I'd be interested to know, Frank, from your point of view, how that environment of having three or four different programs integrated into this class may have influenced some of the thinking and production that have come out of that, and what kind of conversations may have come from that. But it's always, for me, much larger than the singular discipline, but it, because they're all interconnected in different layers of systems, and how one system will draw from another, it pushes and pulls in different directions. So, and I think we're fortunate enough, as Barbara said, you know, we have a safe space to be able to talk about very contentious topics at times. One of the, you know, Barbara and I have had conversations about what it means to have topics of decolonization within the classroom, and how do we convert it from a topic into the actual program, so it's not isolated or separate, and how do we continually engage within that within a new way of developing awareness, consciousness, conversation, action, and modeling processes out of that. And so I think a paradigm shift enables us to, it opens up that space. But I feel that we were fortunate enough to at least already have that safety to do that. And in my experience, even with just within that last class, I had challenging conversations that I found challenging personally as well, in coming to terms with the ways, the values of which I had held on to previously and today and tomorrow, about what values are integrated in design, and when is culture a moment in the making. So it brought up some really, really challenging aspects, I think. And that's what, perhaps for me, the interdisciplinarity started to seep into the class. Yeah.
This was the first class I actually took from the IMDb, course offerings. And I think initially there were like three of us or four of us from the DF program in Thinking Through Making. And I know the IMDb has interdisciplinary in its title, but like the whole Digital Futures program, all of us come from different backgrounds. We are all interdisciplinary in a way. And everybody in my cohort, like, has completely different skill sets, right? And but when I was part of the Thinking Through Making program, that was amplified in some ways because you guys had a certain a certain language, a certain mindset which was different from the DF mindset, right? And y'all spoke in certain terms which were kind of in a way alien to me, and it was like, okay, this is a shift right now I'm having, and I think that is really important. I mean, I feel it's almost a must that like a DF person should take one in this interdisciplinary IMDb course to actually get that experience, because that is, I think, really valuable, because it really rounds you out when you're thinking about things, right? Because you are immersed with your cohort. You're really thinking, you're always surrounded by the same conversations. You're having the same conversation. But when you're going out into the world, and like, I've lived in different parts of the world, and like, it's like being in a multicultural society. Like, you got to be able to actually understand what the other person is saying, where they're coming from, what has been their life experiences, right? And like, just within that building, like, you guys are across the hall, and when I step across the hall, you guys are like I'm in a small microcosm of a different kind of world, right? And like, you know, you guys are looking at materials. The guys are looking at like art in a different way. The guys are scrutinizing how straight something is on the wall, while as I'm just putting it up, and she's like one of the Sheetal looked at my installation, and my poster was like twisted, and she was like how is that acceptable? Like, what's going on there, right? And like, she went into this whole narration of exhibition design and all of these things, and it was a lovely conversation to have, because I don't have those conversations with my DF cohort, right? Like, I think if we can encourage that within the graduate building itself, I know a lot of people who did Thinking Through Making, their projects actually carried forward to the final projects. Like, I don't know how many people you've spoken to, but a lot of people who I've spoken to, I've actually seen that they had started it there, or they came to the class because they wanted to try something out. And even Jessie, and she started off there, and then now her final project actually has all of the things she started off with there. And like, we had this dialogue, Jessie and me, and she comes from the art world, like totally from the art world, and I come from animation and the technical side of things in some ways. And we then landed up in another class, which where we were talking about affect, and you know, but we had this common dialogue because of Thinking Through Making, and because of a collaboration there, that, you know, even in the affect class, we were able to relate to each other's projects because we had this this common dialogue, this common understanding of things that we could actually connect on. And I'm sounding like a little bit of a fanboy, but like, you know, that's what my whole experience was, like, you know, of being part of this, like, just to bring home what Barbara was saying, interdisciplinary. I think we are completely all of the programs are. It's just, we have to find this sweet middle ground of amalgamation in some ways, that if we can create that within the program, saying that this one program is going to be a must where we are going to actually be with all of these other people, right?
You know, I just can correct one thing. The summer course is not an IMD coded course, so it's a graduate studies course.
Yeah.
And it's designed really for Digital Futures, SFI, IMD, and all the other you know, all the other graduate programs. So only that we have so many more students who are keeners to get into the studios at Hunter McCall, you know, that the IMD would be populating the course.
Yeah.
That's when the dean started to putting a section 2 and this year even a section 3 into place, so we can bring more students together. And I think you put your finger onto that, you know, on graduate school level, you know, we have the real opportunity to bringing different programs together through a studio thinking, not only through theory, because we do it on the theory level. We do it through some electives, you know, like critical theory or post-colonial studies, I think, and other places as Judith's class with the emotion and affect class. You will have different students in there, but it's different when it's through the making, because you show more of your thinking process, and it brings us back to the process thinking, material thinking, hands-on thinking. You're much more vulnerable.
And it's you as an artist, right?
You as an artist, a designer, speculator. But I think it's the critique that we offer with to the work, you know, that we take the time to look at the work. We don't do this with a written paper. We don't expose the writing in such a manner. So maybe it's the critique at the heart of the art school thinking, you know, that is still has still a place to take, I think. And it's being critiqued a lot, you know, even the word critique with its negative connotations of wanting to critique, but actually it's wanting conversation, it's wanting questions, it's wanting some responses. And I don't know, Jay, where you are standing in terms of, you know, the critique language, because I have taught with other faculty, and we are often looking back at, shall we relabel it to take some of the fear away from this dreaded critique day? Although then everyone in the end enjoys the critique day a lot, and they want more of the critique day. So there's some ongoing thinking and adjustment, I think, to be done about this. What is the role of critique in a contemporary institution such as OCAD?
Right. Well, there is the performativity of the language itself. I don't know. I've grown up with that word, but more increasingly, I've become more uncomfortable with it. But not for myself, but rather for others. But I think that the role it plays, the where we are sharing ideas, and I think, sorry, I'm going to roll back for a second. I think a lot of it has to do with how you set it up and how you are, how we can build safe expectations in what it does. You might call it a trigger warning or whatever it might be, but I think by the end of the 6 weeks that we have within that class, we have a pretty good understanding, maybe it's a subcultural understanding of what kinds of dialogue will take place. And that doesn't start right away. It develops, you need to develop that trust. And a lot of that trust is built upon one-to-one scenarios. But it's incumbent upon whoever the instructor is and the technicians to really take the time to understand the individual projects, and the respective perspective of the creator, and that's where the respect is reciprocal and the relationship is built upon. So I think one of the biggest questions that Barbara and I are challenged with right now is figuring out, is it viable, is it possible to even transfer this, even if it were 50% online? Is it even possible to do this in this way? And I'm starting to articulate for myself the questions that we need to discover. How do we develop that trust? How do we really get into the not intimacy, I don't mean intimacy as in, you know, what kind of trauma you suffered or whatever it might be, or I've suffered, but it's like, how do we get to the heart of the matter through the object, even if we have the object removed from our senses? What if we can only do this online, for instance? How does that translate? So I think, you know, going back to the setup and the expectations of the critique, it starts from day one and in how we build that relationship. And not even mentorship, it really is, and trying to dismantle hierarchy in that, from a traditional standpoint.
If I could just respond to that, because I was on the receiving end of the critique and like of this in the class, right? Mm-hmm. And I think one of the really important things that this class used differently in critique was first of all the language I think is learned over time. I think it's something I think artists and art practitioners who are in, I think in schools, especially in art schools, they should actually be training to actually give feedback and solicit feedback, right? And I feel sometimes like some people coming into this who are really young, they do not know how to, first of all, give feedback and also how to solicit it. And I think Jay, with your years of experience, this come kind of, and Barbara, comes naturally to you, where you guys are like constantly giving feedback to people. And there's a genuine, like, you know, you're really interested in actually helping the person, not criticizing them for the sake of like, you know, this is wrong, but like, this is what you should be thinking about, right? Like, you know, actually like understanding the deeper relationship that like art is a very personal thing. Like, and the minute you start using words like critique and you start saying things about somebody else's work, it's just natural that the person takes it very personally in some cases. And in my case, it has happened a couple of times, but I feel I had to learn the language of giving feedback before I can even actually understand, you know, what the person is trying to say, because that, I think in the real world, when you go and you're trying to get projects done, you constantly have to give feedback. And that's the biggest skill you got to learn in life, is like, if you want to work with the team, you want to work with people, you've got to constantly get, like, especially if you're an art director or a creative director, like you've been, it's like, how do you get people to do what you need to get done, and done in a way that is like not just like what's expected, but push them beyond the expectations, right? Like, and that is done only through really good feedback, because there's that feedback loop where the person takes the feedback and they're like, you know, F it, I'm not going to do anything with this because I just hated the way it was presented to me, right? Or actually, oh my gosh, like, I'm actually capable of so much more, and maybe I can try this. I'm going to take this risk, right? Like, you know, and that conversation of, yeah, I think was really well, I don't know how, if it happened naturally because we were very respectful of each other's work in that space, but like all of the feedback that I got from people, everybody was being supportive in some way. They were being critical, but they were also being very supportive. Like, you know, like they were coming from a place of empathy rather than just of like, I don't like this. It's just like, you know, you didn't spend much time on it or whatever, right? And that was my taking away from like how critique, like how I see critique and how I see, you know, feedback. The word feedback is more appropriate in my terms.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it's also, you know, when we are naming the project that we are talking about, a prototype, you know, rather than a final work, a body of work, you know, that there's much more emphasis on this is my final say, while prototyping towards allows me, you know, to take the critique in for the many layers or levels of functionality, bringing across a concept, you know, material finesse, et cetera. So there's so many levels of how my viewer or my audience can engage with the work. But the object that they are facing is just the thing that we are communicating through.
Yeah.
So it's not that it has to be only successful. It's also meant, because it's prototyping, it's meant to allow also questioning. It's meant allow to feel riddled by it, questioned by it, you know, by its presence, by its mistakes, by its falling apart. So I think there is a bit of a discussion we could have about the meaning of prototype. And when is it no longer a prototype? Or is there such a thing of having exceeded that prototyping stage and now it's becoming the work? And how does our relationship now change with this thing? I'm sure you both can speak to that as well. But I started after the summer class. I used for my assignments the word usually object or project, and now I'm changing to prototype one, prototype two, prototype three. And I give my students the opportunity to either build on the previous work, or I say, I don't mind if you're building on, but I also don't mind if you come up with a new prototype. Mm-hmm. So there's suddenly much more excitement, I think, in producing more prototypes, more work, and often they are actually pretty good final pieces to present, you know, in such a short time frame we are working together. So I think there's something with this prototyping that is actually design language, particularly industrial design, production design, product design, language that comes quite handy, and there's more to be taken from, I think. I need more language around this prototyping, where the word comes from, and what it does in design and how it's different to art, but it certainly holds a lot of potential.
Mm. It's interesting you bring that up, Barbara, because the first year that Imani and I ran the studio course, the word itself was met with some skepticism, I think, and mainly because I think it was unfamiliar in the context in which we were using it. For instance, if someone came from an artistic background, then prototyping wasn't necessarily the word to use when we're thinking about stages or of creation. And I didn't think anything of it at the time until we had that conversation. So that was when I realized that there are some, if I may say, unnecessary divides, I think, between art and design, because it all shares the same intent of discovery, and, you know, maybe instead of experimentation, it's called innovation, right? And prototyping, from, I didn't think twice about it, but, you know, when initially writing it down, it's from when we're talking from a business standpoint, it's really just a low risk, low cost way of developing experimental ideas with potential high output. So it's that, you know, easy entry, accessible way to get engaged with an idea very quickly and rapidly. And I think that's what we initiated with our first project with the cardboard, being low risk and what it turned out to be, high reward, I think, in a lot of instances of the prototypes that we saw. So in that way, like, some of these aspects were designed, I think, into the course. Just a side note, I will have to leave shortly. So I just wanted to, I apologize if I have to leave early.
No, I think I have more than enough. I mean, I just wanted to just comment on the whole idea of prototypes, because that's and like the low fidelity of things, because that's what I used cardboard and a lot of tin foil with the kids, and that gave them the freedom to actually iterate and they didn't have that pressure that this is precious, right? Like this is something that I can't recreate. They were just creating these objects, and like even me, when I like, they weren't looking at me to judge. Like some of them were creating beautiful things, but some of them were just trying to get to the end result. But when I started taking pictures of it, they started polishing up these prototypes of theirs because they all wanted their picture of their prototype to be taken. So initially they were just like playing around, but that playfulness of not having this pressure that this has to be perfect, like really freed them up. Like, you know, and I think it's the language that is really important when you're conveying it to students and like to even to the kids when I was talking to them about what the expectations were. Yeah. That language makes 100% of a difference. Like, you know, even Barbara thinking about these small things, like saying prototype instead of saying, you know, object, like you may think it's a small thing, but it's a very, very big shift in like what the expectation is at the end of it, right? And that really showed even in the first prototype where we had to make these things of cardboard and we made funky things of like walk-in telephone booths in weird places, like, you know. And thank you so much, Barbara and Jay. I mean, this was a fantastic conversation and I have so much to take away from it. But I'm so grateful for all the time you guys have given me, and I hope you guys are safe and
yes,
can see each other again in person soon.
Yeah, thank you.
So that brings us to the end of the second episode. In the next episode, we will be talking to Andrew Duff, who is the creative director of the Maker Festival in Toronto and also the Future of Making Unconference that was held at the Ontario Science Centre. He'll be sharing with us his journey and also, you know, the Makersphere in Toronto and how that came about.